I didn't even know I could control the levels until right now. I'm just learning how this fucking
works. This has already turned into a great night. We've all learned something.
Okay, folks, welcome to another No Mind podcast. Man, it seems like it's been weeks since we've been talking because
I think it has.
I know, yeah. Darren and Lenny have been off traveling Europe with their band, so there's been quite a few weeks since we've been together. Anyway, before we get to the actual topics tonight, I want to remind everybody, first of all, thanks for tuning in. And if you've got any comments or questions, again, my personal Facebook page, the No Mind Podcast Facebook page, or an email to nomindpodcast2021@gmail.com. So happy and so relieved to be back. Man, I miss it when we don't do these things every week or every 2 weeks. Tonight, we're missing one. Lenny's off. I don't know where Lenny is. What? Vacation?
Dingle.
What?
it's an area called Dingle.
Dingle?
Dingle.
Okay. Lenny's off in Dingle, so he's not here tonight. But Bob and Darren are, so we're just going to go with the three of us. Darren. How you doing, man? It's been a couple of weeks.
I'm all right, and you're right. It seems like it's been forever. We were away last week, but even being away, you feel like you're still missing something, even though other things are going on and you're away for a reason or whatever. So it's good to be back.
Bob.
Hi. How are you? I'm fine. I'm directly quoting from a National Film Board cartoon from the 70s. But it wouldn't go over well in this day and age. Anyway, yeah, everything's great, and I'm great, and I hope everybody's great. And yes, let's dive into the topics du jour.
Tonight's podcast is going to be called Meanderings on a Friday Night, because we don't have a specific theme for tonight. I wasn't even planning on doing one. Well, I was. Bob and I thought Darren was off with Lenny and in Dinglehoff or wherever Lenny is. So Bob was going to come up with some talking points, which he did. And then he and I talked, and he was like, oh, I don't know if they're really good or not, and blah, blah, blah. Yeah, Darren sent me an email after I had sent them to him, and he said he kind of liked the talking points. So let's do this. We're going to go around the table. Everyone will have an opportunity to bring up a topic, and we'll talk about it. I'm sure we'll get lots of conversation out of it, and we'll just see how it plays out. So anybody want to go first? Darren, Bob, me, who?
I can.
Oh, yes. Bob, go.
The first talking point that I came up with sounds like it might be fruitful for like 2 minutes or so. I was thinking, all right, we all were brought up in a specific style, and that specific style dictates that you do techniques a certain way. And I was just wondering if we could sort of pontificate about why the techniques are done exactly the way they are. Like, for example, your chambered fist is palm up, and then you extend the arm, and then at the very last split second, you twist it over palm down. For example, something like that. Why do we do it? Is there a good reason? You know, boxers certainly don't do that. So why do we? And what do you think?
First of all, I actually fucking love this topic. When you get into the intricacies of technique that we did growing up, you took everything verbatim because we didn't know any different. So yeah, you just assume this is the best way to do it. And then as you learn, you either start to learn different ways or you become brainwashed and you can't see any other way other than what you were told. And that's how you preach the techniques and you're not accepting right. anything else. I love that idea. And the other thing is, still, boxing would be similar. There are certain ways that you punch, but they can tell you why those are those ways, and it has a practical purpose that's been tried every day in the ring kind of thing. So there are ways that they do things and techniques, and this is the way you hold your shoulder when you punch, and this is the way you duck your head, but it's all based on practicality, not on tradition or anything like that.
Darren makes a really salient point, and I want to concentrate on it. We do stuff traditionally in our style because that's how we're told to do it. I don't know about you guys, but I'm constantly in review mode and, okay, we do this because I was told to, but does it really make sense to do it that way? Darren's right. Boxing does stuff because everything in boxing is focused around it being practically applicable in a boxing match. I don't think we have that that level set in our style. We don't necessarily do it because it practically works. Although I can't think of another reason to do it other than it does practically work. So,
well, I you know, everybody spends a certain amount of time thinking about why the techniques are done the way they are, presumably.
And, I think that's giving a lot of credit. I don't think very many people spend time thinking about that at all.
Some people spend more time than others, but I always thought that the reason why we started with a punch at the hip, palm up, and kept it palm up on the way out was to keep the elbow in rather than turning the elbow out, which kind of is less strong. If you want to do push-ups, isn't it stronger to do them palm up with your elbows in than palm down with your elbows out?
But it
depends on what you're working on. Elbows in, you're working on your triceps. Elbows out, you're working on your chest.
No, but all other things being equal, which one is stronger?
The thing is, Bob, when you're doing a push-up, really the only part of your body that moves, like you engage your core and your legs and all that stuff, but the only part of your body that moves are your arms. If I'm doing a hook punch and my elbow specifically comes out and around on a hook punch, but I'm not just using my arm, I'm using my body motion, I'm using my feet, right?
Yeah.
So accentuating that motion with other parts of your body explains why that motion generates power.
All right, all other things being equal, let's say you were just standing vertically, standing up, not in a stance, like a natural stance, your feet are even with each other,
yeah.
And you had to punch something as hard as you can, would you want to do it palm up or palm down, or does it matter, or is there a difference?
Scientifically, I think what Mitch just said a second ago with the rest of your body coming into play, if you're just standing completely stationary, do you know what? We could have a load of topics just picking apart different techniques and why they're practical and not. But it reminds me of being in a horse stance with, as you said, chambered fists with your palms up. And if you just stuck out your arm, it doesn't matter whether your palms up or down. There's no difference in power. It's in the hip. So I think with what you just described, it doesn't matter how your palm is. The power
I'm not
is
sure
generated
about that. I'm not sure about that.
I'm positive. Well, no, I'm not. Sorry, I'm not positive. I think even just sitting here, I'm actually throwing my arm out as we speak.
Yeah,
and I just can't see any extra power being generated, regardless of which way my wrist is facing.
Let me
of your arm going out.
Let me throw another level on this. I was taught that as you extend your fist, it twists at the very end. I personally don't think that twist at the end adds any power at all.
I think it's, that's what I'm saying.
I think it's a waste of movement, frankly.
And how many people have been knocked out by uppercuts? So if you have your palm chambered and you just lift right up into someone's jaw, that's the only power is generated with no twisting of the
But again, that all depends on the motion of your body. If you're at a standstill, an uppercut will have very little power.
And that statement assumes that the only purpose of the punch is to generate enough power to knock somebody out. If you're looking at how much power can I as an individual, I as a human being, how much power can I generate? It doesn't matter whether it'll be more than enough to knock somebody out. So the question isn't, is it enough to knock somebody out? The question is, how much power can I physically generate? And I don't know that twist at the end matters at all relative to that. I think
when I was young, when I first started, I thought that twist at the end created some sort of vortex of forces that would somehow
suck my opponent into hell.
anyway, but I don't think that's true anymore.
So let me ask you something. Does everybody agree that, look, let's say we take for granted, because Darren's right, we could spend all night talking about the vagaries and the individual techniques, but let's talk about a punch, a basic punch starting palm up, and as it's extended, just before contact, the punch turns over. Does anybody believe that twist at the end accentuates the amount of power you generate in that punch?
If you do or don't believe it, remember those machines, and they still have them, where it just has the what do you call it, the little punching bags hanging down from the machine.
Right.
In an arcade, you put your bags right. And you do it. So if you could set up something like that, well, they have them in loads of modern gyms now, then you could stand there and do all your different punches, whether it's a side palm like Bruce Lee used to do, or palm up like a chambered fist, or palm down, or in a hook formation. And you could actually test it. And I believe they'd all be basically the same unless you threw extra body or shoulder into it. But if you just kept everything straight, I don't think it matters where your palm's facing.
I think karate practitioners, especially traditional ones, who do their punches and stances and front stances specifically, are absolutely sacrificing a ton of power. Look, boxers learn how to punch the way they punch because it effectively knocks people unconscious, and they have decades of evidence supporting their technique. Our club, we weren't allowed to make contact. All we have to judge the power of our technique is either what we're told or what the rare times we use a punching bag. So I think I'm going to defer to the boxers. I think stepping forward in a front stance with a reverse punch is infinitely weaker than stepping to the side and doing a proper hook punch from a boxing perspective. I think boxers just, by definition, generate more power because that's the whole point of their training, is to generate enough power to actually do some practical damage.
Here's a question. Mitch, you did a lot of board breaking in your mm-hmm. lifetime. How would you rather break, let's say, I don't know, concrete? How would you rather break, you know, four slabs of concrete with a boxing hook punch or with a hammer fist, or I guess it would be a hammer fist? Or, no, your only choice is a boxing hook punch or a reverse punch.
Does this assume that those concrete blocks are facing me on a horizontal plane?
Yeah.
A boxing hook punch. If I've got to answer your question, I would rather, I'd much rather do it with a boxing hook punch.
You'd kind of like hop, skip, and jump across the room and sort of just wing your whole friggin' body into it.
Having said that, I think that hook punch motion allows for that generation of momentum way more. So I would definitely defer to that. Sorry,
but remember, Derek, it was just because he used a reverse punch and a hook punch. They're two different punches, but you said a boxing hook punch. But remember, a reverse punch is the same as a cross in boxing.
Yeah, but it's done differently. Like our,
if your question was which do you think, like just as you guys were starting that topic, I was thinking, I remember, still staying within the topic, I remember we used to have, say, a front stance, and you threw your reverse punch, and if your heel came off the floor, you got trouble for that, because in a front stance, you had to have your back heel on the floor, and it never moves, because the power was generated from the floor and up through your leg.
Yep.
In the first kickboxing class I went to, they said, oh, Jesus, lift your heel off the floor. And I said, well, I thought your power was... And they said, no, that stops your power. You're trying to let your power go on through the person, so you have to twist your hips. That heel has to come off the floor. And at that time, I felt that was completely right. As soon as my heel came off the floor, I felt I was generating extra power. You got a bit of extension on your cross, or as reverse punch, if you want to call it that way, and that effectively worked. So right there, that was the very first kind of contradiction to what I had learned prior to that.
I love that analogy, because when I teach reverse punches from a front stance, I am completely militant about keeping that back heel planted on the floor. But keep in mind that stepping forward in a front stance with a reverse punch is a completely different application than moving around a ring in a kickboxing or a boxing environment. Both generate a ton of power, but at the end of the day, which one generates more? I'm going to have to say standing there with your heel planted in a reverse punch, but which one's more practical? Which one marries more effectively power and practicality? For sure, lifting that heel up and moving. You can't lock yourself into a front stance in a boxing match. You'll get clobbered because you're you're static for way too long. You need to be more dynamic when you're moving around. I think it's all about goals. Like, what are you trying to accomplish? And what's the environment in which you're trying to accomplish it? So I kind of come in on both sides. I see both sides of that equation.
I would like to add to that in this, because I don't know scientifically, but it could easily be proven. Again, if you have the little punching bag or something that measures the strength, to use a front stance, throw your reverse punch with the heel down, and then do the same thing with the heel up, and just note the difference. And scientifically, right then and there, you can see whether which one generates more power. I wasn't using it in a fluidity context of moving around a ring. I was actually using it into the scientific thing, saying that if I stop the flow of my energy going through, which I feel is, that's what you're doing if you keep your back foot on the ground, I think you're limiting the power. But I'm just, that's off the top of my head. I'd like to actually see this stuff scientifically done.
Listen, we've talked about a reverse punch for a long time. How about another technique which will get a real debate going, and that is a roundhouse kick.
Once again, here, I'd love to do that. That's why I said, I didn't mean that we could talk about this all night and not get anywhere. I actually meant as a topic.
We were brought up in a specific style. How faithful should we be? How faithful should we be to this style if that's the one we profess to teach?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, it depends. Well, that gets back to, why are we teaching it?
And
like, are we teaching to be practical? Are we teaching to be traditional? Are we teaching to just generate?
Here's another thing. I think tradition starts somewhere, and we don't know where it started before we learned it, and we don't know how bastardized it might have became by the time we learned. There's no reason it can't start at our teaching, and then 100 years from now, someone says, where'd you learn that style? Well, it started in 2022 by blah, blah, blah. You know what I mean? I mean, it sounds odd, but that's really where tradition comes from, something that's way before.
Well, and look at how much the style changed just from 100%. Our head instructor.
Exactly. Or even from, if you go back and watch, or if you go back and read, what's the one that Funakoshi did, where he does the katas and stuff in the book and everything?
Oh, the master text.
Yeah, something like that. Like, they don't even do that nowadays. It's like the Bible.
Karate Do Kyohan.
Oh, the Kyohan, that's right. Okay, do we want to explore this? Like, do we want to take a technique and just yak about it for 15 minutes?
Well we did the reverse punch. Let's do the reverse punch.
I mean, we don't have to do 15 minutes. We just quickly explain why this is fucked and why this is practical.
Let's do a round kick. That's a fascinating one there.
Yeah, because as far as I'm concerned, it's been 100% proven that lifting your knee out to the side and then trying to swing it around to the fucking person you're attacking is completely ridiculous.
Although, I don't
throw them anymore like that. I can't.
I don't disagree, but I will say that doing it that way was an incredibly good balance exercise, and it taught a lot about body mechanics and how... Now, look, the kick is ridiculous. It's slow. It's weak. It's nonsensical from any perspective other than that's how our style did it traditionally. Having said that, there's some good to be drawn out of the way that we did it. But look, I don't argue for one second that the way we were traditionally taught to do round kicks is nonsense.
And on that, because I think, say the front stance, when you get low, low, low in a front stance, my understanding, you guys can correct me if I'm wrong, it's totally impractical. But the idea was, if you can move really fast in the low front stance, that when you actually get up into a natural stance, you're like lightning. I assume that was the whole idea of putting that round kick the way we traditionally do it. So that if you can do that as fast as possible, when you actually just move from the floor to your target, it's all the more faster.
I understand that. And I understand that, and it's a good point.
That's not my point. My point was, why not just practice going from the floor to your target a million times and let that other shit go?
Yep.
Plus, not only did practicing in a really low front stance, if you did that, it'd make your movement quicker as you came up in your stance, it also fucks your knees completely. So when you turn,
I was just gonna say, I'm still right, fucked from that.
I'm sorry, my knees are completely fucked, and I am absolutely convinced it's because not only the depth of the stance, but the rotation of your feet in your stance puts an incredible amount of torque on your knees.
Well, let's talk about a horse stance.
Oh, that's
that was my topic. That was that part of that whole would you train the same way as before. Suggestive topics for future,
right?
Was that kind of stuff like, would you do that shit again? Would you impinge that on your students?
I don't think the front stance position is necessarily a bad thing. I think they don't need to be that low. Like, so no. Your front knee is pushed out over your foot. Your back, you're all fucking spread out over the whole dojo. No, all you're doing is wrecking your knees, and I can attest to that because I did it religiously for years, and my knees are fucked. So, there you go.
That's anecdotal at best. We need some statistics here.
Yeah, here.
Well, I'm fucked. My knees are fucked. So.
Oh, there's two. That's a fair sample of the population.
There you go.
Well, it's fucking two-thirds of this conversation.
Yeah, we got a 66th percentile sort of...
Oh, my knees are fucked also, so there you go.
Okay, that's a good 30 minutes right there. Let's jump to it. I'm not sure if we resolved anything. But so that was Bob's question, right?
Yeah.
Darren, you want to go next, and I'll go last.
Jesus, I thought, what, I couldn't feel that we were done with Bob's question. Like,
great. Hey, look, if we want to explore that more, I'm all for it.
Well, what was Bob's question? I mean, we must conclude just, it, or at least kind of taper out. We can't leave it at that, because I don't think we did anything there.
Okay, like, so...
We discussed it, but I don't think we came up with anything that anybody can use.
Bob, recap.
Oh, man. The debate on exactly how to do any specific technique is so involved and so interesting and so... that it defies encapsulation in one podcast episode.
That's not what I got here.
Honestly, though... Look, traditional methods of performing technique versus, I don't know, call it modern or more practical methods, because I don't think traditional necessarily equals practical, but I really think it's all about context. What are you trying to accomplish? What are you trying to teach when you're teaching a particular technique?
Hey, I think
that's the key, and I'd like to know if you're doing it for a non-practical reason, a non-competition kata aesthetics reason, why would you teach a method that, I mean, by definition, doesn't seem to have any purpose?
I've got an answer to that, because when you're, and we talked a little bit about it already, when you are stepping forward in a front stance with a middle reverse punch, I do believe that in the context of doing that technique, planting the back heel and doing your reverse punch generates a ton of power. It's not practical in any kind of realistic environment, but it does teach you a lot about body mechanics, and it does allow you to perform an incredibly powerful technique. So if your goal is, I want to train so that I can generate as absolutely much power as I'm able to, then I think that particular technique has a lot to offer. I need to marry the amount of power I'm generating to a practical application, I would never do a front stance. That's insane.
It goes back to I got nothing against, let's say we're doing lines and we're in a half-ass front stance because my knees can't go into a full front stance anymore anyway, so I don't see the purpose of doing it when I was a kid, and I can't do it now, so it has zero purpose now because I can't get into a low front stance. So if I'm doing lines across the room, my stance is going to be smaller, but I will still be putting everything into that reverse punch in that shorter stance. But by definition of practicality, the shorter stance makes more sense. So why did I originally do it in the low stance that doesn't have any practical purposes, when I can do it in the much more comfortable, much more practical, and less harmful in my body, natural stance?
Because I think the lower stance, I believe, and maybe I'm wrong, but I believe the lower stance does allow you to generate more power.
If you're standing in front of a Makiwara and you're putting as much power as you can into it, what would your stance be?
It would be pretty low. For me, it would be quite low.
I would do it as a natural stance for sure.
Are you saying a natural stance? You're saying you can generate more power in a natural stance with a
reverse punch? No, when I say natural stance, not as we describe it in karate where your feet are apart.
Do you know what
I mean? I meant, what do you call it?
Sort of a fighting stance, like a relaxed.
Exactly.
Sort of
yeah, exactly like that, yeah.
I would love to get together sometime and prove this out somehow.
Like, here's an example. If Mike Tyson is trying to score the highest on the little casino
punching
bag thing, do you think he will get into a perfectly good front stance and throw a reverse punch and generate more power than if he was in a natural stance
but
and
this,
just threw a cross?
But that brings up an interesting question because he's never been trained to do
that. I know. Right. I knew so you were going to counter with that. But I just think if you took someone that, say someone like who's your man in the UFC, Wonderboy Thompson, who trained in karate and now fights in the UFC. I'd actually like to, he does a podcast. I might even email him and say, listen, he's obviously done all this stuff. He's making $1 million. So he's done the scientific thing. And if I said, which generates more power? Because he came from a traditional background.
It'd
just be interesting to see. Like, I'm not throwing my argument out there. I'm actually interested in knowing which would work.
It's interesting that you brought up Mike Tyson because I was thinking about Mike Tyson too. If Mike Tyson had six slabs of concrete in front of him that he had to break vertically, how would he do it?
That's an interesting point because...
Do you know what I think he would do? He would face to the side and use his whole body in a hook to break the concrete that way.
That's interesting.
So, sorry, Bob, the concrete slabs are on a horizontal plane or a vertical plane?
No, the way you break them.
Oh, so they're,
sorry.
They're stacked.
Yeah,
I wouldn't do it that way. I was thinking of something different.
Without any training or without any discussion beforehand, hey, Mike, here's six concrete blocks. Go ahead and break them. I would be interested to see whether he could. Not because I don't think he's capable. Obviously, the guy's a monster. Even now, it's 59 or whatever age he is. The guy's huge.
But the thing is, that brings up, like, they tape their hands and they've got the gloves. It's a completely different ball game.
That's my point. He's never, I would assume he's never been faced with that particular challenge before. He's got no training in how to do that. I'd be interested to see whether he could or not. I don't know whether. Look, I don't want to be on the receiving end of that guy's hook punch, but he's trained his whole life to do that. This is a different animal. And I think, again, it all comes back to context. What technique generates the most power? What's the most effective? Well, it depends on the context under which you're asking the question.
We threw out Mike Tyson. There's like a million boxers that strive to be champions, and they will never make it past the amateur level, but they're still training as hard as a champion. They just don't have whatever it takes to be a champion. You can't just say, you know, what if Mike Tyson broke it or whatever. Let's just take a guy that's trained his whole life, but he's just nowhere near Mike Tyson's strength and capability. Could he be able to do it?
Break it. Look, we all know that breaking concrete is all about show. There's a little tiny bit of skill just knowing how not to break your hand while you're doing it. But
didn't you break your hand once?
No, I never did.
I
chipped a bone in my wrist. Yeah, I did.
Yeah, well, that's fucking painful.
no doubt. No argument here, my friend. But look, I can train, and I did this. There was a Don Sproul. You remember Don Sproul?
Yeah.
We were at a Halloween party, and it was around a time we were doing a demo, and I had a concrete block, and I in 5 minutes, I showed him how to break a concrete block. It's easy to
do. Did he break it?
Oh, yeah. Break
it. That's funny. After all these years, I thought that was really difficult.
It's not. It's no harder than breaking a board. It's just different, and it's like everything. It's hard until you learn how to do it, and it's not a big deal. So
oh, that's deadly. I always thought it was really hard. And I thought that's why you were the only one that did it. Tony didn't do it. John didn't do it. I didn't do it. It was only you. And I thought, fuck, nobody can do this.
Yeah.
I wasn't about to do it.
Fuck that shit.
That's what I'm still thinking. Well, I might know how to do it. I could do one.
But no, it's all about it. Look, there's a technique to it for sure, and it takes a little bit of blah 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 blah. But it's certainly no indicator of anything other than the fact that you spent 10 minutes figuring out how to do it. So breaking, I consider breaking to be showy, and you do it at demos, and isn't that interesting? But I don't think it's indicative of anything really.
I mentioned something earlier that I'm reminded of again, and that is the way the boxers tape their fists and wear gloves, and we would never do that. Like, we hit things with our bare knuckles, and that's kind of a huge difference. I wonder...
What were we hitting with our bare knuckles?
Well, I mean the makiwaras and the concrete blocks.
Yeah, but that
blocks
has given it. The makiwari bar has given it. Somebody's skull doesn't.
Maybe the makiwaras that you hit, but that's fine.
Let's look at this from the other side.
Well, here.
Why do boxers tape their fists?
Because they break their knuckles.
Exactly. Holding your fists in a super solid, tight fist for 45 minutes or however long their fights are is incredibly difficult. So they tape them so that they're solid by nature, like their hands are so tight because of the tape,
and they don't even have to think about tight. They can have their hands relaxed. That's bizarre.
No. Here, there's loads of I can't remember boxers and stuff like that, but loads of UFC guys break their hands in a fight and finish the fight with a broken hand, and then they got to get surgery. And all
yeah,
that
yeah.
Shit. Even with all the tape and everything. You can
but let's understand that UFC gloves are what, 7 ounce or something right. Like that. Boxing gloves.
Yeah,
are
but,
12.
But Bob's talking about no gloves. That's what I mean.
I'm talking about karate versus boxing.
Boxers break their hands.
They do. I'm just saying that the reason they tape their hands is to reduce the likelihood of injury.
Oh, of
and
course.
And they don't have to tighten their fists. They can leave it relaxed. They can use their relaxed fists as a component of the speed of their punch.
I still think they tighten the fist at the end of the punch.
I would assume that they have to hit with a reasonably tight fist. I don't think the taping on boxers' hands tightens their fist.
What's it for?
Just what I said. It protects your knuckles from breaking. When you figure, like, here's the best example is, and I mean, this happened to me one time. If somebody uses their elbows to block the punch and you punch that elbow directly, you will break your knuckles or fingers or something like that. If they're not taped. So the taping keeps everything so locked together that it becomes
that's,
more of
that's what the glove does.
No, it no, doesn't. The glove, that's the thing. The glove the doesn't.
The glove cushions the amount of pressure that hits your hands. The tape reduces the likelihood that whatever pressure does get applied to your knuckles will break your knuckles.
I think that the tape allows the boxer to punch with a relaxed fist.
Okay, let's...
I think that's probably part of it, too. I think in the event that your fist isn't really tight, I think Bob's right. I'm assuming, I think. I don't even know the science of that.
Have any of us ever been in any kind of contact fight with our hands taped?
Yeah. Once. I was in a seminar where we learned how to tape our hands, but that was like 40 years ago. Can't go by that now.
So yeah, no, I was in a boxing match where you actually had I had to stand there and have it professionally taped and all that crap going on.
And you actually fought with your hands taped?
Yeah, ridiculous. Like, I hated it. It was like claustrophobic. I didn't like all the tape. And as soon as the fight's done, you just want that shit off.
That's weird, man.
Yeah,
it's against my nature. But there's a satisfaction in doing that, man. Punching with your bare knuckles.
My favorite way of breaking concrete was with a downward straight punch to the concrete. I hate doing it with a hammer fist. I much prefer a straight punch in a downward direction.
It looks better, Stratus.
It's much more satisfying a feeling to break something with a punch than it is to break something with a hammer fist. Breaking is such a fraud, man. People who cut their teeth on, look how good a martial artist I am because of how much stuff I can break. Give me a break, man. It's nonsense. Like, I look at videos of breaking competitions, and I'm just, that guy broke 16 half-inch boards, and you broke 17. Congratulations, I suppose.
Well, I suppose, that's almost another topic in itself. It would be about education and the public's view on things. Like, even when I was training, I was still impressed by certain board-breaking techniques and stuff. Bob, Here's a good one. We were talking about the eulogy earlier, whatever that funeral thing you were talking about. I remember Bob doing the thing where the guy got in a horse stance and the board was right by the side of his head, and Bob did the wheel kick, which I ended up doing later when Bob didn't do it anymore. But to this day, I never did it anywhere as eloquently as Bob did it. And I just remember it was a big thing. He practiced a couple times, and then Sensei would turn the guy's jaw to the board. The audience would laugh. Bob would break the board. Now, we all know, like, a heel kick, geez, you could break a million boards with that. Like, it's so powerful kick. So one board wasn't that big of a deal. But the whole spectacle of it, it was entertaining. And even as someone training, I thought it was entertaining and still appreciate it to this day, even though I know, as you say here, it's a bit of bullshit, but I still get a kick out of it. I still enjoy seeing it. I don't know what to say about it. I think it's an entertaining little aspect.
There's no question that for demonstrations and stuff, showmanship is something you want to put forward. And as nonsensical as breaking is, crowds get jazzed by seeing someone break four concrete blocks or by watching somebody do a wheel kick that just, you know, comes an inch or two away from the ends of somebody's nose and breaking a board. There's no question that that's entertaining.
Sorry, I don't want to interject this. Bob, did you ever hit anybody in practice or in a demo?
Thankfully, no.
Okay, cool. Sorry, no, I was just, because, you know, when you're rehearsing, it just seems that there's so many accidents can happen, and then that, on the day of the demo, it works out perfectly, but there's usually incidents in the rehearsals that somebody got a jaw knocked out.
No, the only accidents during demos were between me and Mitch.
Oh, I split Rick's head open once.
And I split Mitch's head open.
Yes, you did.
I remember that one.
I've still got the scar.
That wasn't an accident.
Yeah, Bob slammed me in the head with that bow on purpose. God damn it, that's hilarious.
All right, I'm sorry. All right, guys. I'll fess up.
All right, we're about 50 minutes in, so 50 minutes. I need to pour a drink, so let's take a little quick break.
Okay, sure.
Okay, folks, we're back from the break. I just want to go once around the table before we get on to the next topic, and I know this is going to throw Darren for a loop because it's putting more of a gap between what we were talking about a second ago and his question, but just to finish off the topic that Bob had brought up about technique, any last comments, Bob?
Well, we didn't really come to any conclusions. We just said, well, people train in different ways, and that's okay, and I guess that's the conclusion. That's it. That's all I got. I don't know.
But that's nothing to be sneezed at. People train in different ways, and people have different goals in mind for what they're training. And I think that defines the validity of how they train.
You know what? I got to say that that's absolutely true. And I really never thought that way until Darren came onto this podcast and started talking about that exact thing. And it really got me starting to think that that's the right way to look at things. And so Darren kind of has taught me something. So thanks, Darren.
Cheers. I'd like to reteach myself that.
Okay, Darren, any last points you want to make about the first hour of the podcast?
Yeah, just what Bob said, I was about to sidetrack onto something completely different as well. But just on the last aspect, I think you could have, not necessarily a whole podcast, but I think we could have delved a little bit deeper, expanded on what we were talking about in relation to the techniques and how they're applied and why they're still done the way they are. And again, to touch on what Bob said, I think different styles do what they do is the reason, it depends on what the reason is for. And I think that's the same as a club. If you're at a dojo and they're training for this reason and you're looking at it and go, well, that's not right, you're doing it wrong, or that's not practical. As long as you're going in and you're understanding that that's the reason you're training and that's why, then you can justify everything. So if you're going, okay, this is why we do the technique this way, is it practical? Well, that's not what we're doing it. we're doing it this way because it's working on this technique, it's working on this body part or this body motion or whatever it is. As long as the instructor can justify what they're doing, I think it's all practical. See, and it's all well
and as long as they don't, make unjustified claims and about the practicality,
or mindlessly do it. And just say, well, that's how we're taught, and leave it at that. As long as you can justify it in whatever way it's justifiable.
But these are really important points, and I don't want to reintroduce the topic. But I think one of the biggest travesties that exist in martial arts schools is when you have someone or a school that trains in a traditional methodology. That's all they've ever done. That's all they ever know, and they claim that it's practical. But all they do is traditional kata and traditional point sparring. I don't even know if the word traditional and point sparring can be used in the same sentence. But we all know that point sparring is not practical. And we all know that, or I believe that, I shouldn't speak for you guys, but I believe that traditional low stance line training has its place for sure, but it's not necessarily practical. And when you get people who run clubs and say, this is what we do, but this is what I'm going to tell you we do, I think that's where we run into some pretty serious problems. I think people would be better off extolling the virtues, understanding the virtues of what they do in their particular style, and then extolling those virtues to their potential audience.
Just based on exactly what you said there, and I know we're trying to move to the next topic, I think everybody listening to this podcast, and you guys as well, could relate to this. You're working for a company, and management introduces something to the company, and everybody working for the company can blatantly see that that is wrong. And they can all say, that's not the way to do it. You need to do it this way. You guys don't understand. We're here on the ground floor. How can you not see this? And I think by virtue of any martial art and any technique, there can always be someone that says, why are you doing it this way? It's not practical.
All right. Like
okay.
Maybe I didn't explain it right.
Look, at the end of the
no,
day...
No, wait, no. There's no use trying to make sure that all your techniques are practical when you're practicing a traditional martial art. It's just not going to work.
No,
so just go with it and learn the style the way it was, and practicality be damned.
But I'm thinking, like, to this day, if I was teaching a class, and if I was doing a traditional class, which wouldn't be my thing now, if any student came up with something and said, why are you doing it that way? I would be able to 100% explain why we're doing it that way. I can justify why it's done. I might not agree with that in a practical term, but I can justify why it's done that way.
Give me an example. I'm not sure about that. Why do we do a round kick this way?
Do it that way.
Exactly. Because that's the
I would go back to what Mitch said about body mechanics, and it's good to know your body. You might not throw it that way, but there's nothing wrong with learning how to balance yourself in order to be able to, whatever the term is, to be able to apply that technique. It might not be the most efficient way, but you are working your body in a way. It was like when McGregor was fighting Nate Diaz, and McGregor was working with this guy that did all kinds of backflips and all these weird body mechanics. And Diaz was making fun of that because he's a straight-on fighter. But McGregor's thing was, he's learning the body mechanics. He's learning how his body moves and what he can do with his body. So it's one thing to just go in and practice, this is how you hit somebody. It's another thing to go, well, that's fine if you know how to hit somebody, but what if you missed? How can your body quickly turn to meet the guy where he is? So if you just practice just straight on punching, and this is the hardest punch, the most effective way, what if the guy's not there when you punch him? Your body has to be able to react to that. And if you don't use all these body mechanic things, you won't be able to react to that. So I think there is something to these weird ways that traditional styles practice, because it does help your body adapt and be able to...
I think it's really important too, especially in the context of the average person who wants to go train at a martial arts club. More than 99% of the people who go to martial arts clubs, they do it as a hobby, as a you know, just something to do on the side. they're not planning a career in the martial arts. They don't plan on, maybe they'll get their black belt, maybe they won't, whatever. You only have a certain amount of training time. And I want to make sure, look, I want to make sure that the limited time I have to train, because I've got a full-time job and I've got other responsibilities, I can't spend 6-7 hours a day training. So I've got to make sure that the time I can spend training is focused in a direction that I consider valid. Now, whether that's practical, learning how to fight, whether it's kata, whether it's this, that, and the other thing, it doesn't matter, as long as I'm able to focus my direction. And I think that's where karate clubs really need to be honest, not only with themselves, but with their students and their potential students about what their focus is, what the direction of the training they're going to get at that club. I think there's too much, hey, everybody should come to my club because my club's the best. It'll do everything and no club will. Understand what your club can do, understand what your focus will be, and that's the market you go after. And I think that's the only moral and fair and reasonable way to do it.
It brings up another point about, like, if you're teaching a specific style, how faithfully should you adhere to that style just because that's the traditional way to do it? And that's a personal decision that every teacher has to come to. Don't you have an obligation to stick to the style as much as as humanly possible? Isn't that a sort of an obligation you hold to history?
I think that teachers who stick to the style for the sake of sticking to the style are cowards and are not free thinkers. And I think that styles evolve. Styles change because people take what's going on in their style and they go, you know what, maybe this isn't right.
So sure, but don't call it that style. Don't call it that.
Fair enough. Call it whatever you want. Well, right. Actually,
you could say it's based on that style.
That, yeah, I think that people who say, I do it this way because it's always been done. I don't have to bring up the gorilla story again, do I? I think that people who do things because that's the way it's always been done have no business teaching.
Yes, you do. I forget the gorilla story.
I love this story. I might cut it out of the podcast, but I'll tell it. It's very quickly, a scientist takes 8 gorillas and he puts them in a room, big circular room. And in the center of the room, there's a flight of stairs leading up to a banana hanging off of a rope. So all the gorillas in the room, and sooner or later, one of the gorillas sees the banana and he decides to go up the stairs. And as soon as the gorilla hits the first stair, 10 jets of absolutely freezing cold water shoot into the room and hose down every gorilla in the room. And that pattern repeats. It knocks the gorilla off the stairs. They all go scampering off to the side because they don't want to get in this freezing cold water. But sooner or later, one of them is going to get hungry. He'll see the banana. He goes. As soon as he touches the first stair, same thing. That freezing cold, high-powered jets of water hoses them all down. It gets to the point where one of the gorillas, he'll see the banana.
Hang on. I just have to say, I'm enthralled by this story. Keep going.
I haven't heard it before.
So
I'm already thinking of a way around this.
So,
I'm thinking like a gorilla.
Yeah.
But anyway, one of the gorillas, again, he sees it. And it gets to the point where when the other gorillas see one gorilla approach the stairs, they don't want to get hit with the jets of water. So they jump on that gorilla and beat the living shit out of him because they know if he hits that first stair, they're going to get hosed down with this water.
Well, and that
becomes the pattern now. So after this, they just never use the hose again. But the gorillas are now trained to beat the shit out of any gorilla that goes near that stair. Then they pull one gorilla out and they put in a fresh gorilla. And the fresh gorilla goes, oh, look, there's a banana. And as he goes toward the stairs, the other gorillas jump on him and beat the shit out of him. And he has no idea why. And then that pattern continues. And then the scientists, one by one, switch out the gorillas. So eventually you've got a circumstance where you have 9 gorillas in a room. Anytime one of them goes to the stair, the rest of them beat the shit out of them, and none of them know why. Because none of those gorillas have been hosed down by the water, but they're so conditioned.
That's just a pattern.
Exactly. Wow. And if you could give the gorillas the power of speech and say to the gorilla, why are you beating the shit out of that gorilla? His answer will be, because that's the way it's always been done.
Yeah, no, that's fucking...
Wow, that's a great story.
Did that actually happen? Did that actually happen?
I don't think so. It was in a movie I watched sometime, but it really affected me because I think it's a good story, which is why I default to any instructor who does stuff, because that's how it's always been done, should be beaten up by 9 gorillas. Anyway.
Wow. I'm going to take a couple of weeks to process
dissect that. I like it.
Okay, let's move off that. I want to get to Darren's question or Darren's circumstance, because it sounded interesting. Darren, can you go ahead and just start talking about what you were talking about earlier?
Jeez, you lost me on the gorilla thing. Back in the day, you took the UFC, and they weren't necessarily looking for the best fighter or the toughest fighter or the best athlete or anything like that. What they were trying to do, which everybody knows nowadays, nobody knew it at the time, but nowadays we know the promoters were trying to get Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu on the map and go on from there so they could open up dojos all over and get it in a thing. But at the time, they were pitting the different martial arts up together. So which is the best martial art?
Yeah, do you remember boxing? Muhammad Ali fighting a judo guy? That happened.
Yeah.
And I think it was either him or somebody else that fought a wrestler as well.
Right.
I think it was Judo Gene LaBelle. Was that the Gene LaBelle one?
I don't want to swear to it, but I think.
But in fairness, that was a... What do you call that? Where it's not a real fight, it's a...
Yeah, exhibition.
Exhibition, that's the one, yeah. So nobody was getting injured, nobody was taking it seriously, it was just kind of a show of what the two things can go. But the UFC was pitting all the different martial arts together. Now, in saying that, they didn't get the best of each martial arts in the early days. They just grabbed maybe a celebrity here, somebody there, and it was pretty controversial. Again, if you look back and watch the documentaries, it was controversial. But the idea was just pitting the martial arts up against each other. And in doing that, people started to develop opinions on which martial arts were good or bad.
Uh-huh.
And then the UFC kind of progressed from there, and people started to denounce certain martial arts because they weren't effective, and only Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu was effective because he won it like 3 out of the first 4 times,
right,
or something like that.
Yep.
So everybody was like, oh, everybody has to learn Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, you have to have a ground game, and everybody rushed to Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. And then a little while later, American wrestlers decided that they could nullify Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu because of their wrestling techniques. And wrestlers came in, and suddenly Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu was no good. You had to wrestle. And then the kickboxers were all useless, but all the kickboxers had to do was learn how to defend a takedown, and they could knock out the wrestlers. And all of a sudden, kickboxing was the best thing. And then after a while, the wrestlers learned how to do enough kickboxing that they could nullify the kickboxers and still take them down. So then the kickboxers had to go back and learn more wrestling. And it just kind of evolved like that. And it ended up becoming a mixed bag, which, as we now know, became mixed martial arts. But in that, since that it's become mixed martial arts, it's almost evolved now that people will go back and learn a particular style and just touch on the other ones enough that they can, as long as they excel in their style, they can nullify the other ones effectively to be really good. So we're back in the day where, what style do you pick as your predominant style?
Mm-hmm.
And because it's like, what they tried to say was, no, now everybody needs to be all-rounded, you're just a mixed martial artist and that's it. And that worked for a little while. And then that's starting to change, and they've decided you actually have to be really good in one style,
right,
and just learn enough in the other styles to nullify them so that you can apply your own style. Now, we're not talking, again, you can't use the UFC as the pinnacle and go, well, that karate guy, he's never going to be a champion. We're not talking about the pinnacle. We're talking about the average guy that wants to be an all-round fighter. what discipline do you go into? That's, like, we're almost right back to the start.
That's such a complex question, because a lot of it depends on individual ability. Like,
would define, as a kid, your individual ability, which discipline would you go into as your forte? How do you decide where to go? Now, obviously, it's going to be based on what you want to, what your outcome is, but there's so many styles out there. You have to take one of them.
Look, you have to.
Sorry, Ronda Rousey started in judo, right?
Right. Yeah, totally. She was an Olympic judo.
Right. So, and it's like that.
She's a great example.
Yeah, like Darren says, whatever you start off with, and your strength is that, and then you round yourself about.
But what I'm saying is, what do you start off with? What do you pick? Like, if you're just a young person coming up now, it's easy for us to say whatever's there.
No. I think now different styles and different martial arts are, I don't want to say universally, but certainly more broadly available. It depends on which art captures your attention, which discipline captures your thoughts. Like, ooh, that looks really cool, I want to try that. Or that looks really cool, I'd love to do that. The thing is, there's a difference, though, between what captures your attention and what you might be naturally suited to. And this isn't... I'm going to go on for a second here. When I was younger, I used to believe that you could be as good at anything as you chose to be as long as you were willing to put in the work. However, I still believe that. However, I also believe that there are things that some people are more naturally suited to than others. So I think it's a marriage of, if you're lucky enough at a young age to lock into a discipline that not only captures your attention, but also happens to be something that you are physically predicated toward, that's going to be obviously the best case scenario.
When we were growing up in our town, you were extremely limited.
Yeah.
And that was that wasn't a small town.
Like, that was 1975. Small town by
North American standards.
But that's why I said right now there are so many, like even in Peterborough where I live, which is a town of about, I haven't counted lately, I've put around,
I think.
Yeah, around 75,000. I can take judo, I can take jiu-jitsu, I can take Brazilian jiu-jitsu, I can take karate, I can take this, I can take that.
But you're still limited to, if there's one judo club,
that's true.
If that instructor is not very good, you're stuck. Yeah.
But to answer your question, what discipline should you follow? That's a really hard question to answer. And I don't know that, when I was coming up, I joined karate because I love, like, judo was a thing. And was there a judo club back then? I don't remember.
No.
Like, I knew of judo, but it karate, like the punching and the kicking, really appealed to me. But now I have to wonder, is that because that's all I was exposed to with Bruce Lee movies and this and that? If I'd seen, someone name a judo movie.
Ta.
Right. If I'd been exposed to judo on the same level that I'd been exposed to the stand-up arts, would I have been more predicated toward that? It's a really complicated question.
That's interesting. And I can't think of any judo movies, but I remember loving judo. Mitch, I'll ask you quickly. Do you know why I don't like judo?
Yes.
You don't like going upside down. Exactly.
No, it's exactly what Mitch just said. I don't like going upside down. I love the fucking art. I love being the instigator. I don't like being the partner that has to go upside down. And that's always prevented me from doing it. I would love to learn all the techniques. But if they were okay to say, look, you don't like going upside down, we'll teach you the techniques. We're cool with that. All the students have agreed that you can do that. But that's it. That'd be great. I would love to learn all the techniques.
I'm pretty sure none of the judo schools are okay with that.
And that's a shame, because I think I'd be really good at it.
That's a shame.
I just don't want to be thrown.
Too bad for them.
Oh my God, that's hilarious.
I remember when somebody was trying to teach him how to do shoulder rolls. It was like fruitless.
Bob, I can do shoulder rolls.
Mitch, what am I recalling here? There was an episode where I think he was trying to do them and couldn't do them.
I've got some vague memory of it, but I can't remember.
Yeah, same here. Yeah. Okay, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe
I know
I'm wrong
I have tried.
No, I can do shoulder rolls and I can do somersaults. Yeah. No, and I can do dives over weird shit and everything. I don't like when somebody totally takes. I can go upside down when I control it. I don't like being thrown by somebody else. That's the thing.
I remember.
I don't even like takedowns for fuck's sake.
I'm probably thinking of an episode like way early in your career.
I remember classes or Saturdays where, and this is after I've taken judo for a little bit, where Darren was there and the head instructor was like, okay, throw Darren. And oh my God, it's like you go in to fit in to throw him.
Like
and
the white belt dude.
Every ounce of his strength is dedicated toward not letting you throw him because he does not want to go upside, which is actually really good from learning how to do the throws.
From an evolutionary point of view.
Exactly. Do this thing. Nope.
I haven't evolved that far yet.
Right.
No, you were.
He has a higher chance of surviving the next generation.
That's my point. Darren's evolved further than we have. He's like, fuck that. Why would I let you do that to me? I'm not doing that. No.
Technically, yeah, that could be the, what do you call it, like my MMA thing where it's like, no, I'm blocking that. I'm stuffing the takedown. I'm blocking the throw.
Yeah.
Exactly.
That's the next turn that MMA will take. Don't go upside down.
Not doing it. Funny enough, when I moved out west, I got involved with the Hat Keto Club. I went through it over and over, and I went to class after class, and you were thrown and thrown and thrown and thrown. And I never got used to it. I never got comfortable with it. And I remember saying to the instructor, I don't like going upside down. I can't do it. I'll do everything else. And he went and he goes, oh, no, you'll get used to it. And we went over and over and over. And I stuck it out for a good 3 months, like going 2-3 times a week. Never got used to it. I hated it every fucking time. Never got used to it.
So
don't like it. I guess that's why I wouldn't pick those arts.
So let's pull this back to Darren's question, which is, how do you choose the art form you want to go with? And it's, I don't know. I don't know that there's any way other than seeing what's out there, seeing what's available to you wherever you are, and trying to marry your interest with what you can logistically get into.
The thing is, I'm a boomer, and back in the day when I was young, there was like one choice. There was
zero
choices. There was one alternative, and now, with a vast array of dojos that you can choose from,
it's a different
my
world.
Sympathy ends. You fucking just choose something. Who the fuck? Fuck you.
You got 50 choices. I had one.
Right.
That's great.
I would be just like going to like a gym, like just lift the weights and stuff, and you go to all the different gyms and find out which one feels comfortable or whatever.
But there's a difference there because gyms pretty much. One gym's the same as the next. There's the weights. You lift them up. You put them down. Blah blah blah.
And no,
you're right. Every gym has a different atmosphere, and every gym has a different vibe to it. But what you do in the gym kind of stays consistent from gym to gym. Martial arts, which martial art you choose, is going to define in a very real way, and in a very different way, martial art to martial art, and even club to club, what you do and how you do it.
That's what I was thinking. It'd be a drag if you chose, say, judo and said, yeah, I think that's what's for me because I love going upside down. So you go to a judo club, but if everybody at the club's an asshole or, you get bad vibes, they don't have proper mats, you're injuring yourself, and you go, judo sucks, and you go somewhere else, you've kind of lost out on everything judo has to offer because
club. That touches on a point I was going to make, and that is, unfortunately, like everything else, if you're a beginner, you don't know what you're doing when you choose a club, and it's going to be by ignorance, and you just have to kind of dive in, and it's going to be messy, and it may be the wrong club, but you have no choice. You don't know, so you just got to, like, do.
It really is a minefield. It's a real labyrinth for people who don't have any experience and but would like to get into it, because they've got nothing more than the desire to do it. And there are so many variables amongst the different clubs that that you've got to navigate through to find that club or that discipline that speaks to you or that you're comfortable with. I think now more than before, like Bob, when you and I, and Darren, when we started, there were so few choices. I think on some levels, that made it easier. Because
I had no choice.
Right, well, exactly, because your dad was the head instructor. So. Yeah.
but then like, these poor beginners who join a club and they don't know that their head instructor is this frickin' cult leader wannabe, and yeah. they get drawn into that
yep.
shit.
It's like I said, it's a minefield. And unfortunately, look, Bob, how many years were you training before you realized the negativity that existed in that environment?
Six, seven
right.
years.
So you were well into your black belt, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's tough. It's an environment when you what? Okay, Darren, I got to ask you. You've trained in far more clubs than Bob or I've had. I've trained in a bunch. Bob trained in a bunch, but I think you've had the greatest breadth of experience. Do you find that most of the clubs you've trained in have this quote unquote cultish perspective? Or are most of them cool? It's like, hey, come on in. Let's just train. We'll work out. You don't have to come and cut my grass or wash my car or re-roof my shed. Just come in and we train and we work out. If you had to tag a percentage on the cultish martial arts clubs versus the non-cultish ones, how would that percentage play out?
Wow.
My first thought was around 50-50, but maybe 60-40 lean toward non-cultish.
Oh, so like but, 60% non-cultish, 40% cultish?
Like my first thought was 50-50, but no, probably it was a little less than 50-50 in the sense that there were more legit clubs than cultish.
How does that depend? How much of that depends on which martial art we're talking about?
The interesting thing in what Bob just questioned was when I experimented with other arts like judo, hapkido, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu and stuff like that.
Sorry.
I would have been very low in my knowledge, so I wouldn't have known at the time whether it was cultish or not, if you know what I mean.
That's a good point.
That's another point that I don't know if we touched on, which is, like I asked Bob, how long into your training did you realize that was kind of the environment that you were mired in?
But then after you realize it, then you're free to go about and find clubs that are not like that, and it's much easier.
How many people
that goes never... back to the beginners? Like at least I could say here, that's not it. You guys are fucked, and
yeah.
I can split. But if I don't know the difference, then I'm stuck in that genre or vein or whatever it is. But I got caught up in clubs before because I don't know. If I go take Hapkido, I don't know enough about Hapkido to know whether the club's legit or not. Until you get in there and you start feeling the students out, and they're either mind fucked or the instructor does something stupid, like he hits you. Like I trained at one club one time, and the guy was an MMA fighter, and I'm going lightly because he's the instructor, and he was doing a couple of things, and I'm actually thinking, actually I can handle this guy. It's not a big deal, and I was throwing leg kicks just because that's what you do when you spar, and then he grabbed my leg kick and he just tossed me, and I'm like, okay. I threw the leg kick slow because we're sparring.
Right.
If you're going to toss me, I'm now going to throw it faster so that you can't do it. But I'm not trying to embarrass you in front of your fucking students.
Right.
And it ended up, at one point, he got in, he took me down with one of them stupid throws that he did, and I got him in a triangle. And I was about to let the triangle go, and he stood up and dropped me and snapped my neck. Like, I actually I couldn't train for another 3 months after that.
Jesus.
And he was caught in the triangle. And I'm like, you're not in the ring.
Wow.
You're just sparring. And he was the head instructor and the owner.
Never underestimate the lengths that club owners and instructors will go to safeguard their egos in front of their students.
Except for Lenny.
Yeah, I gotta say, with Lenny not here, I'm quite impressed with how willing he is to put himself out there in terms of how his students perceive him. But again, I've experienced much the same thing you have, Darren, where you go into a club and the head instructor is there and they present that they almost feel threatened by you and they don't want you to overshadow them, and it's an interesting exploration of ego.
It reminds me of when we had that club in
Swansea. Yeah.
And you would occasionally get an experienced student in, but the headspace is interesting because you really want to make sure that you hold yourself up and you don't embarrass yourself, but at the same time you want to be a fair and good teacher, and it's a whole dynamic.
I don't know, man.
It's a whole dynamic.
I have a great deal of respect for instructors who are willing to say, I don't know everything. And maybe you'll get a student who has experience in areas you don't and will be better than you at things.
Sure.
And I've experienced that at clubs too, where an instructor will go, wow, this guy or this person has more knowledge than I do in this direction.
Yeah.
And they're not threatened by them. They're able to integrate them into that environment without feeling threatened by them. I think that's a really rare and lovely thing.
Funny enough, we'll go back, say, maybe 10 or 15 years, to touch on all those points, there's one where somebody comes in and they're better at what you're doing, and they think they can, they're like, well, why should I pay to train here? And it's like, well, maybe you shouldn't. You have to decide.
Right.
Do you have a bunch of workout partners, and you have somebody that's not as good as what you're doing, but they're a coach and a teacher, and they can watch what you're doing and take you far beyond whatever level you're at now. Maybe if you're rolling on the mats or sparring, you can beat them. But does that make you a teacher or a coach? That just means at this particular point in time, you can beat them in point sparring. That's one aspect right there. And the other one is, from a teacher's point of view, or from both point of view, if I go into a new dojo, my object is not to beat everybody and beat the instructor and show them how good I am. I'm there to learn. And the other thing is, if you're an instructor...
Well, no, you're there to learn. Not everybody is. A lot of people go in there just to try and fuck around.
And then the other aspect, if you're the instructor, your job isn't to beat everybody up to prove how good you are. But you have to go to your own limitations and realize you're an instructor, coach, teacher, not necessarily the best fucking person on the planet.
But see,
your job is to guide everybody through it.
This is the problem, or the inherent danger of running a martial arts club, because you may get people who come in who do what you do and are better than you at it. That's a tricky circumstance. How do you deal with that?
Well,
the best club I train.
It just reminds me of a tiny episode when I was younger and I was trying to learn how to play a harmonica. So I practiced a fair amount on my own, and then I looked up some sort of place in my neighborhood, some guy who would teach it, and I went to his place and he said, no, I got nothing to teach you. You're as good as I am. And that's the same situation.
I was going to say, the best club I trained at was when I first started with the grappling. The guy that was teaching, like, he was better than he was better than all of us because I just started, obviously, but he was learning. And the whole ethos as the club is we will all learn together.
Right.
And if anybody was training outside the club or watching YouTube videos or had a technique they wanted to try, everybody jumped in and tried it together. So if one guy was really good, that didn't make him the instructor. The instructor was still the guy running the club, but he wasn't necessarily the best guy in the club. He was the guy running it and organizing it and ensuring that everybody was advancing. And some people advanced way beyond him, and there was one guy that actually went into the UFC. So he outdid the instructor, and that's fine, but he wouldn't have got there without training under that instructor.
I think that's a really rare and amazing perspective. I think that instructors who are able to say, I don't know everything, I might not know anything comparatively, let's all just kind of wade in and see where this takes us as a group. I can't imagine a a healthier perspective in a club.
I can't imagine a healthier perspective, and I can't imagine a club like that.
Yeah, let's just say I haven't experienced another club like that since.
Yeah.
Which is a shame, because it is pretty good that everybody's just there to learn and help each other. I'm sure there's loads of clubs out there. I just haven't been in one of them since.
Look, I think every club would claim to say, we're all here to learn together. Let's take this trip. But I think when that instructor is faced with someone who's actually better than they are at things, for them to go, this person's better than me, let's learn from them, let's embrace the fact that they're better than me, I think that's a much harder circumstance for a lot of instructors to navigate. All right, guys, where the hell are we? I had a topic I wanted to kind of cover, but you know what? It'll keep for another podcast. Let's go around the table once. Anything else you want to say about this? Darren, that was an amazing conversation. Considering all your misgivings, I thought that was awesome. Okay, Bob, any last words you want to say before we bring this one to a close?
Not really. That was fun. Each one of these topics I want to continue talking about, and presumably we will, especially arguing about how to do specific techniques. That's fun because it's, first of all, it's fruitful. What do we do? Reverse punch? Didn't even do a round kick. So we have hundreds of techniques to go over. It's going to take a while. But anyway, yeah, that's...
47 years worth of podcasts ahead of
us. It's been fun. It's a good conversation.
Good conversation.
As it says in The Last Samurai.
In The Last Samurai. Darren, what do you think?
Yeah, I was just, like, just following up on what Bob said. When was the last time you saw anybody ever knocked out by a ridgehead? Like, it just doesn't fucking happen. Why would I ever throw a ridgehead?
Mike Chapman has caught me a few times.
The thing is...
did he knock you out?
It was non-contact tournament.
Yeah, but so. this gets back to context. I've scored tons of points at tournaments.
Yes, because it's so deceiving. But if you tried to use that in a fight,
exactly.
You would just hit the guy's skull and he would punch you in the head.
That's my point, is again...
So ridge hands now become redundant.
No, they don't. It depends on the context of the tournament you're in. If you're in a street fight or you're in a full contact fight, I'm right there with you. Don't use ridge hands.
Then it goes back to, why am I taking an art that uses something that will not defend myself?
Now we're talking about
self-defense.
But now
I know I don't want to open a can of worms here.
Too late, man. Look, there are some clubs that okay.
You know what I think the most useful thing we've ever done is henchy hose.
Oh my god.
Let's go around the table for some conclusive remarks.
Oh my god.
Sorry. Let's go around the table to open up another can of worms.
Jesus.
More topics.
All right. Thanks for your input, Darren. I appreciate your thoughts, Darren. Let's close out this podcast. Oh my god.
Sorry, I didn't mean to do it that way. It was
awesome. We could talk for an hour or two just about those. Look, practicality versus non-practicality. There's an entire podcast about that. my last thoughts are going to be just, I've already reiterated it. I think a lot about the validity of what you do and how you do it is based on the context in which you do it. I think there are a lot of people who join the martial arts with no intention of ever getting into a fight or being in a practical circumstance, whether it's on the street or in a tournament. And I don't think that invalidates...
Which is 100% fine.
Right, exactly. I don't think it invalidates why they choose to do it. So whether a technique works or doesn't work or is valid or is not valid is based completely on the context in which the technique is performed, and there you go. So
that's a great point, and that's a great finishing thing, because I hate to go on the topic that's not practical, therefore it's useless and let's never do it, blah blah blah. There's so many aspects of that, like things like kendo, things like weapons. You know, when are you going to walk down the street with a pair of nunchakus or sai or a bow or anything like that? They're not practical, but they're highly entertaining. It takes a lot of work to do. It takes a lot of skill to do. It takes a lot of motivation. C- concentrate. Do you know what I mean? And if that's what you're into, that's your forte. And it's the same as if you decide to be a soccer player or a football player. Unless you're going to make it into the NFL.
Soccer playing won't help you in a fight.
I know. But what I meant, if that's what you love doing, you're never going to make a career at it. You're never going to be in the upper echelons where you're competing against those type of people. Therefore, what's the purpose? Well, the purpose is because you enjoy doing it.
Exactly.
So if you enjoy doing these simple weapons or traditional martial arts or something like that, if that's what you enjoy doing, I'm not condemning anybody for doing that stuff. This is exactly what we're all about here. The podcast is not about whether it's practical or whether you're tough or you're not tough. It's just, it's a round the table kind of thinking. And if that's what you're into, that's all the power to you. And I'm into a lot of that stuff as well. I'd love to be able to do that. I don't concentrate everything I do on practicality. It's also about enjoyment and everything else.
As long as you don't have to go upside down.
I'll go upside down at times if it's required. I just don't like it.
But anyway, I'll say it again. I said it before and I'll say it now. I really very much appreciate and value Darren's perspective on this stuff. I don't know. He's all encompassing. He says, whatever you enjoy, just do it. And I don't know why that's so strange to my way of thinking all these years, but it is. And I'm embracing it.
No, I agree. Guys, this has been a great conversation. I'm surprised we only got through two talking points in the entire thing.
Are you actually surprised? Because I looked at Bob's talking points and I'm like, geez, we could cover this in 10 minutes. We could do this. But then you can almost know that, no, it's going to go on forever.
Exactly. We got to stop this sometime. All right, guys. Thanks a lot. Again, folks, any comments, questions to the No Mind Podcast Facebook page, my personal Facebook page, or send me an email at nomindpodcast2021@gmail.com. Bob, Darren, guys, thanks for coming out, and we'll see you next time.